is not much bigger than the Solvay waste beds. Assaults on Onondaga culture continued. Parents tried to hide their children from Indian agents, but they were taken and sent to boarding schools like Carlisle Indian School. The language that framed the great law of peace was forbidden. Missionaries were dispatched to the matrilineal communities in which men and women were equal to show them the error of their ways. Longhouse ceremonies of thanksgiving, ceremonies meant to keep the world in balance, were banned by law. The people have endured the pain of being bystanders to the degradation of their lands, but they never surrendered their caregiving responsibilities. They have continued the ceremonies that honor the land and their connection to it. The Onondaga people still live by the precepts of the great law and still believe that in return for the gifts of Mother Earth, human people have responsibility for caring for the non-human people, for stewardship of the land. Without title to their ancestral lands, however, their hands were tied to protect it. So they watched, powerless, as strangers buried the peacemakers' footsteps. The plants, animals, and waters they were bound to protect dwindled away, though the covenant with the land was never broken. Like the springs above the lake, the people just kept doing what they were called to do, no matter what fate met them downstream. The people went on giving thanks to the land, although so much of the land had little reason to be thankful for the people. Generations of grief, generations of loss, but also strength. The people did not surrender. They had spirit on their side. They had their traditional teachings. They also had the law. Onondaga is a rarity in the United States, a native nation that has never surrendered its traditional government, never given up its identity, nor compromised its status as a sovereign nation. Federal laws were ignored by their own authors, but the Onondaga people still live by the precepts of the great law. Out of grief and its strength has come a rising power, a resurgence that became public on March 11, 2005, when the Onondaga Nation filed a complaint in federal court with the goal of reclaiming title to their lost homelands, that they might once again exercise their caregiving responsibilities. While elders passed on and babies became elders, the people held to the dream of regaining their traditional lands, but they had no legal voice by which to do so. The halls of justice were closed to them for decades. As the judicial climate gradually changed to permit tribes to bring federal suit, other Haudenosaunee nations filed claims to recover their lands. The substance of these claims was upheld by the Supreme Court, which ruled that Haudenosaunee lands were illegally taken and the people greatly wronged. Indian lands were unlawfully purchased in contravention of the United States Constitution. New York State has been ordered to forge a settlement, though remedies and reparations have proven difficult to find. Some nations have negotiated land claims for cash payoffs or land gains and casino deals in an effort to find relief from poverty and ensure their cultural survival on the remnants of their territories. Others have sought to reclaim their original lands via outright purchase from willing sellers, land swaps with New York State, or the threat of lawsuits against individual landowners. The Onondaga Nation took a different approach. Their claim was made under United States law, but its moral power lay in the directives of the great law, to act on behalf of peace, the natural world, and future generations. They did not call their suit a land claim, because they know that land is not property, but a gift, the sustainer of life. Tadadaho Sidney Hill has said that the Onondaga Nation will never seek to evict people from their homes. The Onondaga people know the pain of displacement too well to inflict it on their neighbors. Instead, the suit was termed a land rights action. The motion began with a statement unprecedented in Indian law. The Onondaga people wished to bring about a healing between themselves and all others who live in this region that has been the homeland of the Onondaga Nation since the dawn of time. The nation and its people have a unique spiritual, cultural, and historic relationship with the land, which is embodied in the Gayanashagoa, the Great Law of Peace. This relationship goes far beyond federal and state legal concerns of ownership, possession, or other legal rights. The people are one with the land and consider themselves stewards of it. It is the duty of the nation's leaders to work for a healing of this land, to protect it, and to pass it on to future generations. The Onondaga Nation brings this action on behalf of its people in the hope that it may hasten the process of reconciliation and bring lasting justice, peace, and respect among all who inhabit this area. The Onondaga Land Rights Action sought legal recognition of title to their home, not to remove their neighbors and not for development of casinos, which they view as destructive to community life. Their intention was to gain the legal standing necessary to move restoration of the land forward. Only with title can they ensure that mines are reclaimed and that Onondaga Lake is cleaned up. Tadadaho Sidney Hill says, "We had to stand by and watch what happens to Mother Earth, but nobody listens to what we think. The land rights action will give us a voice." The list of named defendants was headed by the state of New York, who illegally took the lands. But the suit also listed corporations that have been responsible for degradation, a quarry, a mine, an air-polluting power plant, and the more sweetly named successor to Allied Chemical, Honeywell Incorporated. Even without the suit, Honeywell is finally being held accountable for the lake cleanup, but there is great debate about the best approach to dealing with the contaminated sediments so that natural healing can go forward. Dredge, cap, or leave it alone? State, local, and federal environmental agencies are all offering solutions with a range of price tags. The scientific issues surrounding competing lake restoration proposals are complex, and each scenario offers environmental and economic trade-offs. After decades of foot-dragging, the corporation has predictably offered its own cleanup plan, which involves minimum cost and minimum benefits. Honeywell has negotiated a plan to dredge and clean the most contaminated sediments and bury them in a sealed landfill in the waste beds. That may be a good beginning, but the bulk of the contaminants lie diffused in the sediments spread over the entire lake bottom. From here, they enter the food chain. The Honeywell plan is to leave those sediments in place and cover them with a 4-inch layer of sand. It would partially isolate them from the ecosystem. Even if isolation were technically feasible, the proposal is to cap less than half of the lake bottom, leaving the rest to circulate as usual. Onondaga Chief Irving Paulus characterized the solution as a band-aid on the lake bottom. Band-aids are fine for small hurts, but you don't prescribe a band-aid for cancer. The Onondaga Nation called for a thorough cleanup of the sacred lake. Without legal title, however, the powers that be will not give the nation an equal place at the negotiating table. The hope was that history would turn itself to prophecy as the Onondaga Nation combed the snakes from the hair of Allied Chemical. While others quarreled over cleanup costs, the Onondaga took a stance that reversed the usual equation in which economics takes priority over well-being. The Onondaga Nation Land Rights Action stipulated a full cleanup as part of the restitution, no halfway measures would be accepted. Non-native people of the watershed joined with them as allies in their call for healing in an extraordinary partnership, the neighbors of the Onondaga Nation. In the midst of legal wrangling, technical debates, and environmental models, it is important to not lose sight of the sacred nature of the task, to make this most profaned lake worthy of the work of water again. The spirit of the peacemaker still walks along these shores. The legal action concerned not only rights to the land, but also rights of the land, the right to be whole and healthy. Clan Mother Audrey Shenandoah made the goal clear. It is not casinos and not money and not revenge. In this action, she said, we seek justice. Justice for the waters. Justice for the four-leggeds and the wingeds whose habitats have been taken. We seek justice, not just for ourselves, but justice for the whole of creation. In the spring of 2010, the federal court handed down its ruling on the Onondaga Nation suit. The case was dismissed. In the face of blind injustice, how do we continue? How do we live our responsibility for healing? The first time I heard of the place, it was long past saving. But no one even knew. They kept it hidden. Until one day the sign appeared, eerily, out of nowhere. H-E-L-P. Green block letters big enough for a football field, just off the highway. But even then, no one paid attention. 15 years later, I moved back to Syracuse, where I had been a student, and watched those letters fade to brown and die away along that busy stretch of road. And yet the memory of that message hadn't faded for me. I needed to see the place again for myself. It was a fine October afternoon, and I had no classes. I wasn't sure exactly how to find the place, but I'd heard rumors. The lake was so blue you could almost forget what it was. I drove past the backside of the fairgrounds, long closed for the season and desolate. But off a dirt road at the perimeter, I found the security gates wide open and swinging in the wind, and I went in, mine the only vehicle in a back lot designed for thousands of fairgoers. It's not like there were maps for what lay beyond the fences, but there was a lane of sorts heading off in the general direction of the lake. So off I went, being sure to lock my car in this lonely place. I'd be just a while, back in plenty of time to pick up my girls after school. The lane was just a rutted track through a thicket of phragmites, the reedy stems so densely packed as to make a wall on either side. I had heard that every summer the manure from the state fair barns was dumped out here. The mucked-out stalls of blue-ribbon dairy cows and midway elephants all ended up on the waste beds. The city later followed suit, dumping tankers of sewage sludge. The resulting paddy was completely overgrown, plumed seed heads towering over my head by several feet. My view of the lake and my sense of direction were lost in the craze of stems, all rubbing and sawing against each other, rocking in the wind with a hypnotic sway. The lane forked off to the left, and then to the right, and became a walled labyrinth without landmarks of any kind. I felt like a rat in a phragmites maze. I took the fork that seemed to go lakeward and began to wish I'd brought my compass. There are 1,500 acres of wasteland along this shore. Even the sound of the highway, usually a good direction finder, was lost in the swishing sound of the reeds. A niggling suspicion that this was not a good place to be alone crept up the back of my neck. but I talked myself out of being afraid. There was absolutely no one here to worry about. Who would be crazy enough to come to this godforsaken place? Who but another biologist whom I'd be happy to meet? Either that or an axe murderer disposing of a body in the reeds. It would never be found. I followed the track as it twisted and turned until I caught a glimpse of the top of a cottonwood. I could hear its leaves in the distance, an unmistakable sound. It was a welcome landmark. Another bend in the lane brought the tree into full view, a big cottonwood with thick spreading branches that hung over the road. From the lowest branch hung a human body. Next to it, an empty noose swayed in the wind. I screamed and ran, taking any path I could find, panicked and walled in by the reeds. With a pounding heart, I ran blindly on and on, and then met the dead end of every horror movie. Here in a tableau of terror stood an executioner with a black hood, muscled arms, and of course, a dripping axe. A woman's body was draped over the chopping block, her blonde curls spilling from her severed head. I did not move. And neither did they. At all. A space had been cut from the thicket to form a reed-walled room like a museum diorama with life-sized figures poised at the point of murder. Relief poured off me in a cold sweat. No dead bodies. But the palpable presence of some twisted imagination was only a marginal improvement over actual corpses. To make matters worse, I was now entirely lost in the maze, wanting only to be somewhere else, most especially picking up my kids from the school bus. Thinking of them, I gathered my wits and moved as quietly as possible, wanting to avoid detection by the satanic cultists I envisioned. On my search for a way out, I encountered additional rooms hacked into the reeds, a mocked-up prison cell with an electric chair, a hospital room with a straight-jacketed patient and an ominous nurse, and finally, an open grave with a long-nailed occupant crawling from it. After another long pass through the eerie reeds, the lane emerged into the parking lot. The light stanchions now cast long shadows, and my car was visible way down at the other end. I padded for my keys in my pocket. Still there. I could probably make it. I couldn't see if the gate was open or closed. I turned for one last look behind me. Off to the side, a nicely lettered sign was pounded into the ground. Salve Lions Club, Haunted Hayrides, October 24 to 31, 8 p.m. to midnight. I laughed myself silly, but then I had to cry. The Salve waste beds, how very fitting a venue for our fears. What we ought to be afraid of isn't in the haunts, but under them. Land buried under 60 feet of industrial waste, trickling toxins into the sacred waters of the Onondaga and the home of 500,000 people. Death may be slower than the fall of the axe, but it is just as gruesome. The executioner's face is hidden, but its names are known. Salve process, allied chemical and dye, allied chemical, allied signal, and now Honeywell. More frightening to me than the act of execution is the mindset that allowed it to happen, that thought it was okay to fill a lake with toxic stew. Whatever the companies are called, individual people were sitting behind those desks, fathers who took their sons fishing, who made the decision to fill the lake with sludge. Human beings made this happen, not a faceless corporation. There were no threats, no extenuating circumstances to force their hands, just business as usual. And the people of the city allowed it to happen. Interviews with Solvay workers tell the typical story. I was just doing my job. I had a family to feed, and I wasn't going to worry about what happened out there on the waste beds. Philosopher Joanna Macy writes of the oblivion we manufacture for ourselves to keep us from looking environmental problems straight in the eye. She quotes R.J. Clifton, a psychologist studying human response to catastrophe. Suppression of our natural responses to disaster is part of the disease of our time. The refusal to acknowledge these responses causes a dangerous splitting. It divorces our mental calculations from our intuitive, emotional, and biological embeddedness in the matrix of life. That split allows us passively to acquiesce in the preparations for our own demise. Waste beds, a new name for an entirely new ecosystem. Waste. We use the word as a noun to mean a leftover residue, refuse, or rubbish, or a material such as feces, which is produced by a living body, but not used. More contemporary uses are an unwanted product of manufacturing, an industrial material rejected or thrown away. Wasteland is, therefore, land that has been thrown away. As a verb, to waste means to render the valuable useless, to diminish, to dissipate, and to squander. I wonder how the public perception of the Solvay waste beds would change if instead of hiding them, we put up a sign along the highway welcoming people to the lakeshore defined as squandered land covered in industrial feces. Ruined land was accepted as the collateral damage of progress. But back in the 1970s, Professor Norm Richards of the College of Environmental Science and Forestry in Syracuse decided to conduct one of the first studies of the dysfunctional ecology of the waste beds. Frustrated by local officials' lack of concern, Storm and Norman took matters into his own hands. Following the same lane I walked years later, he snuck into the fenced-off lakeshore and unloaded his guerrilla garden equipment, wheeling his backyard lawn seeder out to the long sloping beds that faced the highway. He pushed the load of grass seed and fertilizer back and forth with measured steps, north 20 paces, east 10 paces, north again. A few weeks later, the word help appeared, written in grass letters 40 feet long on the barren slopes. The scale of the wastelands left room for a longer treatise in fertilized script, but that single word was the right one. The land had been kidnapped, bound and gagged. It could not speak for itself. The waste beds are not unique. The cause and the chemistry vary from my homeland to yours, but each of us can name these wounded places. We hold them in our minds and our hearts. The question is, what do we do in response? We could take the path of fear and despair. We could document every scary scene of ecological destruction and never run out of material for a haunted hayride of environmental disasters, constructing a shocking nightmare tableau of environmental tragedies in rooms carved from a monoculture of invasive plants on the shore of the most chemically contaminated lake in the United States. There could be scenes of oiled pelicans. How about chainsaw murders on clear-cut slopes washing into rivers? Corpses of extinct Amazon primates, prairies paved over for parking lots, polar bears stranded on melting ice floes. What could such a vision create other than woe and tears? Joanna Macy writes that until we can grieve for a planet, we cannot love it. Grieving is a sign of spiritual health, but it is not enough to weep for our lost landscapes. We have to put our hands in the earth to make ourselves whole again. Even a wounded world is feeding us. Even a wounded world holds us, giving us moments of wonder and joy. I choose joy over despair, not because I have my head in the sand, but because joy is what the earth gives me daily, and I must return the gift. We are deluged by information regarding our destruction of the world, and hear almost nothing about how to nurture it. It is no surprise, then, that environmentalism becomes synonymous with dire predictions and powerless feelings. Our natural inclination to do right by the world is stifled, breeding despair when it should be inspiring action. The participatory role of people in the well-being of the land has been lost, our reciprocal relations reduced to a keep-out sign. When my students learn about the latest environmental threat, they are quick to spread the word. They say, "If people only knew that snow leopards are going extinct, if people only knew that rivers are dying, if people only knew, then they would what? Stop?" I honor their faith in people, but so far, the if-then formula isn't working. People do know the consequences of our collective damage. They do know the wages of an extractive economy, but they don't stop. They get very sad. They get very quiet. So quiet that protection of the environment that enables them to eat and breathe and imagine a future for their children doesn't even make it onto a list of their top 10 concerns. The haunted hayride of toxic waste dumps, the melting glaciers, the litany of doomsday projections, they move anyone who is still listening only to despair. Despair is paralysis. It robs us of agency. It blinds us to our own power and the power of the earth. Environmental despair is a poison every bit as destructive as the methylated mercury in the bottom of Onondaga Lake. But how can we submit to despair while the land is saying, "Help"? Restoration is a powerful antidote to despair. Restoration offers concrete means by which humans can once again enter into positive, creative relationship with the more-than-human world, meeting responsibilities that are simultaneously material and spiritual. It's not enough to grieve. It's not enough to just stop doing bad things. We have enjoyed the feast generously laid out for us by Mother Earth, but now the plates are empty and the dining room is a mess. It's time we started doing the dishes in Mother Earth's kitchen. Doing dishes has gotten a bad rap, but everyone who migrates to the kitchen after a meal knows that's where the laughter happens, the good conversations, the friendships. Doing dishes, like doing restoration, forms relationships. How we approach restoration of land depends, of course, on what we believe that land means. If land is just real estate, then restoration looks very different than if land is the source of a subsistence economy and a spiritual home. Restoring land for production of natural resources is not the same as renewal of land as cultural identity. We have to think about what land means. This question and more are played out on the Solvay waste beds. In a sense, the new land of the waste beds represents a blank slate on which a whole range of ideas have been written in response to the urgent message of help. They are scattered over the waste beds in scenes every bit as evocative as the tableau of the haunted hayride. A tour of the Onondaga Lake shore captures the scope of what land might mean and what restoration might look like. Our first stop would have to be the blank slate itself. Greasy, white industrial sludge poured over what was once a grassy green lakeshore. In some places, It is as bare as the day it was spewed, a chalky desert. Our diorama should include a figure of a laborer placing the outfall pipe, but behind him would be the man in the suit. The signpost at stop number one should say, land as capital. If land is only a means to make money, then these fellows are doing it right. Norm Richards' help appeal started something back in the 1970s. If nutrients and seed were all it took to green the waste beds, the city had a ready answer. Slopping sewage sludge onto the terraces of the waste beds provided both nutrients for plant growth and a disposal solution for the output of the water treatment plant. The result was the nightmare swards of Phragmites, a dense monoculture of invasive reeds 10 feet high that excludes all other forms of life. Stop number two on our tour. The sign reads, land as property. If land is just private property, a mine of resources, then you can do whatever you want with it and move on. Scarcely 30 years ago, covering up your mess passed for responsibility, a kind of land as a litter box approach. Policy dictated only that land ruined by mining or industry had to be covered by vegetation. With this astroturf strategy, a mining company that destroyed a forest of 200 species could satisfy its legal responsibilities by planting the tailings to alfalfa under a mist of irrigation and fertilizer. Once federal inspectors checked and signed off, the company could put up a mission accomplished banner, turn off the sprinklers, and walk away. The vegetation disappeared almost as quickly as the corporate executives. Happily, scientists like Norm Richards and a host of others had a better idea. When I was at the University of Wisconsin in the early 1980s, on summer evenings I would walk with a young Bill Jordan through the trails of the Arboretum, where a collection of natural ecosystems had been put in place on abandoned farmland, homage to Aldo Leopold's advice that the first step to intelligent tinkering is to save all the pieces. At a time when the toll taken by places like the Solvay waste beds was finally being understood, Bill envisioned a whole science of restoration ecology, in which ecologists would turn their skills and philosophy to healing land, not by imposing an industrial blanket of vegetation, but by recreating natural landscapes. He didn't submit to despair. He didn't let his idea sit on the shelf. He was the catalyst for and a co-founder of the Society for Ecological Restoration. As a result of efforts like his, new laws and policy demanded evolution in the concept of restoration. Restored sites would have to not only look like nature, but have functional integrity as well. The National Research Council defined ecological restoration thus: the return of an ecosystem to a close approximation of its condition prior to disturbance. In restoration, ecological damage to the resource is repaired. Both the structure and the function of the ecosystem are recreated. Merely recreating form without the function, or the function in an artificial configuration bearing little resemblance to a natural resource, does not constitute restoration. The goal is to emulate nature. If we got back on the hayride wagon, it would take us to a restoration experiment at stop number three, another version of what this land might be, what it might mean. It's visible from way off, in big quilted blocks of vivid green against the chalky white. Moving like a field of grass, you can hear the sound of wind in the willows. This scene might be titled Land as Machine and be peopled with mannequins of engineers and foresters who are in charge of the machine. They stand before the ravenous jaws of a brush hog and an unending plantation of shrub willows, as thick as the Phragmites, and not much more diverse. Their goal is to reestablish structure, and especially function, to a very specific purpose. Here the intention is to utilize the plants as an engineering solution to water pollution. When rainwater leaches through the waste beds, it picks up high concentrations of salt, alkali, and a host of other compounds that it carries right to the lake. Willows are champions of absorbing water, which they transpire to the atmosphere. The idea is to use the willows as a green sponge, a living machine, to intercept the rain before it gets down into the sludge. As an added benefit, the willows can be mown down periodically and used as woody feedstock for biomass fuel digesters. Use of plants in phytoremediation schemes holds promise, but an industrial monoculture of willow, however well-meaning, does not quite meet the standard for true restoration. This kind of fix is at the core of the mechanistic view of nature, in which land is a machine and humans are the drivers. In this reductionist, materialist paradigm, an imposed engineering solution makes sense. But what if we took the indigenous worldview? The ecosystem is not a machine, but a community of sovereign beings, subjects rather than objects. What if those beings were the drivers? We can clamber back on the hay wagon to travel to the next display. Only this one is not well marked. It sprawls across the oldest lakeside section of the beds into a scruffy patchwork of vegetation. The restoration ecologists here at stop number 4 are not university scientists or corporate engineers, but the oldest and most effective of land healers. They are the plants themselves, representing the design firm of Mother Nature and Father Time, LLC. After that momentous Halloween excursion years ago, I felt completely at ease on the waste beds and enjoyed rambling there to watch the restoration in action. I never encountered another dead body. But that is part of the problem. It is, of course, dead bodies that build soil, that perpetuate the nutrient cycle that propels the living. The soil here is white emptiness. Here on the waste beds, there are expanses without a living thing. But there are also teachers of healing, and their names are birch and alder, aster and plantain, cattail, moss, and switchgrass. On the most barren ground, on the wounds we have inflicted, the plants have not turned their backs on us. Instead, they have come. A few brave trees have become established, mostly cottonwoods and aspens that can tolerate the soil. There are clumps of shrubs, some patches of asters and goldenrod, but mostly a thin, scraggly collection of the common roadside weeds. Dandelions, ragweed, chicory, and Queen Anne's lace, blown to this spot, have made a go of it. Nitrogen-fixing legumes in abundance, clovers of all kinds, have also come to do their work. That struggling field of green is to me a form of peacemaking. Plants are the first restoration ecologists. They are using their gifts for healing the land, showing us the way. Imagine the surprise of the infant plants who emerged from their seed coats to find a waste bed habitat no one in their long botanical lineage had ever experienced. Most died of drought, of salt or exposure, or starved from lack of nutrients, but a select few survived and did their best to carry on, especially the grasses. When I dig my trowel under a grassy patch, the soil is different. The waste below is no longer pure white and slippery, but dark gray and crumbly between my fingers. There are roots all through it. The darkening of the soil is humus mixed in. The waste is being changed. True, a few inches down it is still dense and white, but the surface layer holds promise. The plants are doing their work, rebuilding the nutrient cycle. If you get down on your knees, you'll see ant hills, no bigger than a quarter. The granulated soil the ants have mounded around the hole is as white as snow. Grain by grain, in their tiny mandibles, they are carrying up waste from below and carrying seeds and bits of leaves down into the soil, shuttling back and forth. The grasses feed the ants with seeds, and the ants feed the grasses with soil. They hand off life to one another. They understand their interconnections. They understand that the life of one is dependent on the life of all. Leaf by leaf, root by root, the trees, the berries, the grasses are joining forces. And so there are birds and deer and bugs that have come to join them. And so the world is made. Gray birches dot the top of the waste bed, arriving on the wind, no doubt, and lodging fortuitously against a gelatinous clot of nostoc algae bubbling in a puddle. Protected in the selfless scum of nostoc, the birch can grow and thrive on its nitrogen inputs. They are now the biggest trees here, but they're not alone. Directly beneath almost every birch are small shrubs. Not just any shrubs, but those that make juicy fruits. Pincherry, honeysuckle, buckthorn, blackberry. These shrubs are largely absent from the bare expanse between the birches. This apron of fruit bearers speaks of the birds who passed over the waste beds and stopped to perch on the trees, to defecate their load of seeds into the shade of the birch. More fruit drew more birds, who dropped more seeds, who fed the ants, and so it goes. That same pattern of reciprocity is written all over the landscape. That's one of the things I honor about this place. Here you can see beginnings, the small incremental processes by which an ecological community is built. The beds are greening over. The land knows what to do when we do not. I hope that the waste beds do not disappear entirely, though. We need them to remind us of what we are capable of. We have an opportunity to learn from them, to understand ourselves as students of nature, not the masters. The very best scientists are humble enough to listen. We could name this tableau Land as Teacher, Land as Healer. With plants and natural processes in sole command, the role of land as a renewable source of knowledge and ecological insight becomes apparent. Human damage has created novel ecosystems, and the plants are slowly adapting and showing us the way toward healing the wounds. This is a testament to the ingenuity and wisdom of plants more than to any action of people. I hope we'll have the wisdom to let them continue their work. Restoration is an opportunity for a partnership, for us to help. Our part of the work is not complete. In just the last few years, the lake has offered signs of hope. As factories have closed and citizens of the watershed build better sewage treatment plants, the waters have responded to that care. The natural resilience of the lake is making its presence known in tiny increments of dissolved oxygen and returning fish. Hydrogeologists have redirected the energies of the mud boils so that their load is lightened. Engineers, scientists, and activists have all applied the gift of human ingenuity on behalf of the water. The water, too, has done its part. With lessened inputs, the lakes and streams seem to be cleaning themselves as the water moves through. In some places, plants are starting to inhabit the bottom. Trout were found once again in the lake, and when water quality took an upward turn, it was front page news. A pair of eagles have been spotted on the north shore. The waters have not forgotten their responsibility. The waters are reminding the people that they can use their healing gifts when we will use ours. The cleansing potential of the water itself is a powerful force, which gives even greater weight to the work that lies ahead. The presence of eagles seems a sign of their faith in the people too. And yet, what will become of them as they fish from the wounded waters? The slowly accreting community of weedy species can be a partner in restoration. They are developing ecosystem structure and function, beginning ever so slowly to create ecosystem services such as nutrient cycling, biodiversity, and soil formation. In a natural system, of course, there's no goal other than the proliferation of life. In contrast, professional restoration ecologists design their work to move toward the reference ecosystem, or the pre-damage native condition. The volunteer successional community creating itself on the waste beds is naturalized, but it is not native. It is unlikely to lead to a plant community that the Onondaga Nation would recognize from their ancestral past. The outcome will not be a native landscape peopled with the plants who lived here when allied chemical was only a gleam in the eye of a smokestack. Given the drastic changes produced by industrial contamination, it is probably not possible to recreate cedar swamps and beds of wild rice without some help. We can trust the plants to do their work, but except for wind-blown volunteers, new species can't get here across highways and acres of industry. Mother Nature and Father Time could use someone to push a wheelbarrow, and a few intrepid beings have volunteered. The plant communities that will thrive in this environment are the ones that are tolerant of salt and the sodden soil. It's tough to imagine a reference ecosystem of native species that could survive. But in pre-settlement times, there were salt springs all around the lake, and they supported one of the rarest of native plant communities, an inland salt marsh. Professor Don Leopold and his students have brought in wheelbarrows full of these missing native plants and conducted planting trials, watching their survival and growth with hopes of playing midwife to the recreation of a salt marsh. I went out to visit with the students to hear their story and look at the plants. Some were dead, some were hanging on, and some were flourishing. I headed to where the green seemed the strongest. I caught a whiff of a fragrance that haunts my memory. And then it was gone. I must have imagined it. I stopped to admire a thriving stand of seaside goldenrod and some asters. To witness the regenerative power of the land tells us that there is resilience here, signs of possibility that arise from partnership between the plants and the people. Don's work fulfills the scientific definition of restoration, working toward ecosystem structure, function, and the delivery of ecosystem services. We should make this nascent native meadow the next stop on the hayride, stop number 5, with a sign that says, "Land as Responsibility." This work raises the bar for what restoration can mean, to create habitat for our non-human relatives. As hopeful as this tableau of restored vegetation might become, it doesn't feel quite whole. When I visited with the students with shovels in their hands, their pride in the planting was evident. I asked what motivated them in their work, and I heard about getting adequate data and devising a solution and a feasible dissertation. No one mentioned love. Maybe they were afraid. I've sat on too many dissertation committees where students were ridiculed for describing the plants they've worked with for 5 years with so unscientific a term as beautiful. The word love is unlikely to make an appearance, but I know that it is there. That familiar fragrance was tugging at my sleeve again. I raised my eyes to meet the brightest green in the place, shiny blades gleaming in the sun, smiling up at me like a long-lost friend. There she was, sweetgrass, growing in one of the last places I might ever have expected. But I should have known better. tentatively sending out rhizomes through the sludge, slender tillers marching bravely away. Sweetgrass is a teacher of healing, a symbol of kindness and compassion. She reminded me that it's not the land that has been broken, but our relationship to it. Restoration is imperative for healing the earth, but reciprocity is imperative for long-lasting successful restoration. Like other mindful practices, ecological restoration can be viewed as an act of reciprocity in which humans exercise their caregiving responsibility for the ecosystems that sustain them. We restore the land, and the land restores us. As writer Freeman House cautions, we will continue to need the insights and methodologies of science, but if we allow the practice of restoration to become the exclusive domain of science, we will have lost its greatest promise, which is nothing less than a redefinition of human culture. We may not be able to restore the Onondaga watershed to its pre-industrial condition. The land, plants, animals, and their allies among the human people are making small steps. But ultimately, it is the earth that will restore the structure and function, the ecosystem services. We might debate the authenticity of the desired reference ecosystem, but she will decide. We're not in control. What we are in control of is our relationship to the earth. Nature herself is a moving target, especially in an era of rapid climate change. Species composition may change, but relationship endures. It is the most authentic facet of the restoration. Here is where our most challenging and most rewarding work lies, in restoring a relationship of respect, responsibility, and reciprocity. And love. A 1994 statement from the Indigenous Environmental Network puts it best. Western science and technology, while appropriate to the present scale of degradation, is a limited conceptual and methodological tool. It is the head and hands of restoration implementation. Native spirituality is the heart that guides the head and hands. Cultural survival depends on healthy land and a healthy, responsible relationship between humans and the land. The traditional caregiving responsibilities which maintained healthy land need to be expanded to include restoration. Ecological restoration is inseparable from cultural and spiritual restoration, and is inseparable from the spiritual responsibilities of caregiving and world renewal. What if we could fashion a restoration plan that grew from understanding multiple meanings of land? Land as sustainer, land as identity, land as grocery store and pharmacy, land as connection to our ancestors, land as moral obligation, land as sacred, land as self. When I first came to Syracuse as a student, I had a first and only date with a local fellow. We were going on a drive, and I asked if we could go to fabled Onondaga Lake, which I'd never seen. He reluctantly agreed, joking about the city's famous landmark. When we got there, he wouldn't get out of the car. "It stinks too much," he said, as ashamed as if he himself were the source of the foul odor. I'd never met anyone who hated his home before. My friend Catherine grew up here. She tells me that her weekly ride to Sunday school took the family along the lakeshore, past Crucible Steel and Allied Chemical, where even on the Lord's Day, black smoke filled the sky and pools of sludge lay on either side of the road. When the preacher talked of fire and brimstone and the sulfurous vents of hell, she was sure he meant Salve. She thought she drove to church each week through the valley of death. Fear and loathing, our internal haunted hayride, the worst parts of our nature are all here on the lakeshore. Despair made people turn away, made them write off Onondaga Lake as a lost cause. It's true that when you walk on the waste beds, you can see the hand of destruction, but you can also see hope in the way a seed lands in a tiny crack and puts down a root and begins to build the soil again. The plants remind me of our neighbors at Onondaga Nation, Native people faced with daunting odds, great hostility, and an environment much changed from the rich land that first sustained them. But the plants and the people survive. Plant people and human people are still here and are still meeting their responsibilities. Despite numerous legal setbacks, the Onondaga have not turned their backs on the lake. Rather, they are the authors of a new approach to healing it, put forward in their Onondaga Nation vision for a clean Onondaga Lake. This dream of restoration follows the ancient teachings of the Thanksgiving Address. Greeting in turn each element of creation, the declaration offers vision and support for returning the lake to health, and with it, a mutual healing of lake and people. It is an exemplar of a new holistic approach called biocultural or reciprocal restoration. In the indigenous worldview, a healthy landscape is understood to be whole and generous enough to be able to sustain its partners. It engages land not as a machine, but as a community of respected non-human persons to whom we humans have a responsibility. Restoration requires renewing the capacity not only for ecosystem services, but for cultural services as well. Renewal of relationships includes water that you can swim in and not be afraid to touch. Restoring relationship means that when the eagles return, it will be safe for them to eat the fish. People want that for themselves too. Biocultural restoration raises the bar for environmental quality of the reference ecosystem so that as we care for the land, it can once again care for us. Restoring land without restoring relationship is an empty exercise. It is relationship that will endure and relationship that will sustain the restored land. Therefore, reconnecting people and the landscape is as essential as reestablishing proper hydrology or cleaning up contaminants. It is medicine for the earth. One day in late September, while earth-moving machinery dredged contaminated soils on the western shore of Onondaga Lake, another group of earth movers worked on the eastern shore, dancing. I watched their feet as they moved in a circle led by the water drum. Beaded moccasins, tassel tie loafers, high top sneakers, flip-flops, and patent leather pumps all beat against the ground in a ceremonial dance to honor the water. All the participants carried vessels of clean water from their home places. Their hopes for Onondaga Lake were held in these vessels. Work boots brought spring water from the high hills. Green converses carried city tap water, and red wooden sandals, peeking from below a pink kimono, carried sacred water all the way from Mount Fuji to blend that purity into Onondaga Lake. This ceremony is also restoration ecology, the healing of relationship, and the stirring of emotion and spirit on behalf of the water. Singers, dancers, and speakers took the stage by the lake to call for restoration. Faithkeeper Orin Lyons, Clan Mother Audrey Shenandoah, and international activist Jane Goodall joined the community in this water communion to celebrate the sacredness of the lake and to renew the covenant between people and the water. There on the shore where the Tree of Peace once stood, we joined to plant another tree in commemoration of peacemaking with the lake. This should be on the restoration tour, too. Stop number 6. Land as sacred, land as community. Naturalist E.O. Wilson writes, "There can be no purpose more inspiring than to begin the age of restoration, reweaving the wondrous diversity of life that still surrounds us. The stories are piling up all around, in scraps of land being restored, trout streams reclaimed from siltation, brownfields turned into community gardens, prairies reclaimed from soybeans, wolves howling in their old territories, school kids helping salamanders across the road. If your heart isn't raised by the sight of whooping cranes restored to their ancient flyway, you must not have a pulse." It's true that these victories are as small and fragile as origami cranes, but their power moves as inspiration. Your hands itch to pull out invasive species and replant the native flowers. Your finger trembles with a wish to detonate the explosion of an obsolete dam that would restore a salmon run. These are the antidotes to the poison of despair. Joanna Macy speaks of the great turning, the essential adventure of our time, the shift from the industrial growth society to a life-sustaining civilization. Restoration of land and relationship pushes that turning wheel. Action on behalf of life transforms, because the relationship between self and the world is reciprocal. It is not a question of first getting enlightened or saved and then acting. As we work to heal the earth heals us. The last stop on the ride around the lake hasn't been finished yet, but the scene is planned. In this tableau, there will be kids swimming, families picnicking. People love this lake and take care of it. It's a place for ceremony and celebration. The Haudenosaunee flag flies alongside the stars and stripes. Folks are fishing in the shallows and keeping their catch. Willow trees bend gracefully, their limbs full of birds. An eagle sits at the top of the Tree of Peace. Lakeshore wetlands are rich with muskrats and waterfowl. Native prairies green the lakeshore. The signpost at the scene reads, "Land as home." People of corn, people of light. The story of our relationship to the earth is written more truthfully on the land than on the page. It lasts there. The land remembers what we said and what we did. Stories are among our most potent tools for restoring the land as well as our relationship to land. We need to unearth the old stories that live in a place and begin to create new ones, for we are story makers, not just storytellers. All stories are connected, new ones woven from the threads of the old. One of the ancestor stories that waits for us to listen again with new ears is the Mayan story of creation. It is said that in the beginning there was emptiness. The divine beings, the great thinkers, imagined the world into existence simply by saying its name. The world was populated with a rich flora and fauna called into being by words. But the divine beings were not satisfied. Among the wonderful beings they had created, none were articulate. They could sing and squawk and growl, but none had voice to tell the story of their creation, nor praise it. So the gods set about to make humans. The first humans, the gods shaped of mud. But the gods were none too happy with the result. The people were not beautiful. They were ugly and ill-formed. They could not talk. They could barely walk, and certainly could not dance or sing the praises of the gods. They were so crumbly and clumsy and inadequate that they could not even reproduce, and just melted away in the rain. So the gods tried again to make good people, who would be givers of respect, givers of praise, providers, and nurturers. To this end, they carved a man from wood, and a woman from the pith of a reed. Oh, these were beautiful people, lithe and strong. They could talk and dance and sing. Clever people, too. They learned to use the other beings, plants and animals, for their own purposes. They made many things, farms and pottery and houses and nets to catch fish. As a result of their fine bodies and fine minds and hard work, these people reproduced and populated the world, filling it with their numbers. But after a time, the all-seeing gods realized that these people's hearts were empty of compassion and love. They could sing and talk, but their words were without gratitude for the sacred gifts that they had received. These clever people did not know thanks or caring, and so endangered the rest of the creation. The gods wished to end this failed experiment in humanity, and so they sent great catastrophes to the world. They sent a flood and earthquakes, and most importantly, they loosed the retaliation of the other species. The previously mute trees and fish and clay were given voices for their grief and anger.